First of all, I want to thank Paul Casey for having the courtesy of inviting me here. I'm deeply honoured. And that was instigated by John Sexton, who I also want to congratulate. It's a great honour for me to be here tonight. I haven't been in my hometown in 14 years. So I'm with my brother Paul. So, yes, this is quite emotional for me as well. Okay, there's a lot of people I need to thank, to be honest. The Elm Tree, which is mainly what I'm reading from tonight, is published by a Belfast company called Lapwing, who are an independent company run by Dennis Grieg and Amos, his son. And their support of my work has been phenomenal, so I have to acknowledge that. So that's the book I will be reading from. But also, other people, if you like the work that I'm reading from tonight, there's another book here that I very much want to promote. And they're called The Scum Gents. They have a website, thescumgents.com. They're coming from Galway, and Ross Breslin is the editor there. And this is an anthology which, unfortunately, hasn't been reviewed, and is really offering what I would see as a really different kind of take on what's happening in Ireland, in what I would really consider a kind of a renaissance in writing in this country. So that's there on sale if you're interested. Okay. I'm going to sort of, this reading is going to last around 40 minutes, hopefully, if you don't kill me. It's going to be kind of split into two parts. I'm going to read principally from a work called The Dark Pool. I've always kind of done things backwards. This is a kind of a selected works. I've just finished my 9th collection. So the two works I'm focusing here on are The Dark Pool, which will be published by Mauvais Grand, which is Against the Grain Publications, which are based in Paris, France, sorry. Walter Ruhlmann, wonderful poet and editor. So The Dark Pool, Dublin, The Dark Pool. And I'm going to start reading now, because if I start talking about the ins and outs, I'll never stop. The first one is dedicated to my brother, Paul, and it's called The Barman. My customers, tortured by various infidelities, sit around the counter drinking and smoking, some alone reading newspapers or working, others alone staring at the walls, mouths agape, struck once again by the enormity of their own self-imposed exile. While the lucky few in quiet groups of twos and threes break the silence with their laughter and guffaws, consciously joking at the utter stupidity and ridiculousness of their lives, while I pour each and one of them another chance or possibility in the form of this liquid gold. The local. Under the suspended lamps, the manifold moons, the all-encompassing locality hits you like the sharp slap of an intentional elbow to the face. Here, conversations shift like the breeze. Once open, rows of solid entities may cause a further assessment of the transience of all matter. Fiddle and banjo pull to the strains of a singer life, and the sole measure of certitude are the pints. On that, everyone is agreed. The cleaning lady. These are all pub poems, by the way. I'm going to take this rostrum away from me because it's getting in the way. Thank you. the cleaning lady. As if hypnotized by our task at hand, head up, ears cocked like a retriever, she moves through the haze of Mr. Sheen, her opiate now for so many years. She paces the floor, dust claw in hand, which she holds like a bun, cleaning the windowsills, passing the labyrinth of pillars, shelves, walls, and radiators, with the clock ticking away, its face chiding her like just another one of those dirty-faced bastards. Leo. It is raining on the flowers like a funeral. When it stops, the vapor will arise like smoke on the road in the sunlight. There is an old man sitting alone inside an empty bar. His thoughts are spinning inside his mind like pennies upon a counter. Memories are an irritant to him as a dog is to a flea. He scratches them with his tongue and the words pour out of his mouth as graceful as a dictator's pas de deux. With them he brings to the floor a forlorn stage show. The Muppets appear before you in single file. You can see them all so clearly that you accidentally bump into the wardrobe lady. They are all made up of old hair and skin, and some of them are sewn up like old battered teddies. On this particular day, they are all to be found in dancing outside the College of Surgeons. There is an accordion playing freight train rock. Leo, the stoker, fuels it all with vodka and red. The Ninnies, for Jerry Higgins. In public bars, old men cling to their spirits, gods, tears of laughter, like children with toys. The clocks on the shelves announce tedium with a tick, and all manner of danger with a tock. We are always, despite ourselves, in the realm of the divine. I knew his voice, the passively dominant tongue, lying like a crab scurrying beneath the waves of memory, the claw of the words clutching, always in defense for all his life. Hasn't he lived in fear? Except anything but blows, my mother used to say, and there he snits in the snug, probing the listener's face with those intense eyes, while the other sits there with the patience of Job, punctuating the monologue with shovel loads of yap, 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 yap. Head bowed by the weight of the words, he is supporting history. For this is no free-for-all, nor is it conversation, but rather a slow and steady annihilation as continuous as Morse or rainwater. But yet he waits for a lull, full of optimism, balancing in his mind for the right moment to strike out! Which a kick, lightning offensive, which could possibly paralyze the other into a kind of momentary. To 108. It was a Saturday morning. There was not one woman in the place. Everyone was in full voice. It was not a pub or a bar, but rather a saloon, and the atmosphere was one of club or kindergarten. Grey hair and hardened skin, glasses and 12 o'clock shadows reigned. Stools upholstered in old red leatherette were lined up at the counter, awaiting the more worried or overtly anxious to claim them. An old man sat in a corner cleaning his pencil or his ear.
A young father entered and admonished him to sit down there now and behave. Two retired businessmen argued like schoolboys, trying to piece together the events of the previous night over coffee and fizzy water. And I sat amongst them all, imagining God looking down upon us, like a child with his favorite old broken toys. Grand Canal Bank Blues. This is for Paddy Gardner. Ripples appear on the surface like the lines of serenity on a mandarin's face, and all of the Asiatic frailty of his sorrows are given their finest expression through the weeping of the willows, which bow down to the unique majesty of these waters. But beneath this mask, there is a darker side. Burnt rubber, plastic bags, half-rusted shopping trolleys, cigarette ends and cans of Coke and beer float or have sunk beneath the surface. Mementos of a jaded and complacent race. Still, as long as there are no bodies, canal time-locked, we still walk by, not on the water. O'Connell Street Revisited. This is for Brendan O'Grady, who's somewhere in France. Ever so often, you must stop to remind yourself that you are not just walking on a street, but that you are swimming in the river of humanity. The press of aging flesh, frailty, vice, and innocence are all being borne away on Anna Livia's languorous scales. A nonchalant Spanish waiter, Lorca in chains, looks down contemplating the slow ebb of tedium under shafts of golden light which cut the caressing breeze. An illumination then is likened to a summer pasture where every girl is a muse, and the law walks in pairs suitably capped and tied like a surreal androgynous couple. From the bars, the better songs fill the air like prayers. Babylon's bitches are waiting for every day the devil burns them. And middle-aged couples amble along with ease, their pockets and bags of years shared together barely noticeable, while the shyer young hold on to their promise like flowers. And babies bob up in their mother's arms as if at sea, while their fathers look on in disbelief, acknowledging with their eyes life's supreme prize. I follow each and every one of them. When our eyes meet, I extend an invisible hand and clench them warmly. With my words, I uncover them. Poets are like chambermaids. See, I part the curtains of your hair. The Night Watch. This is for Thomas Kinsella. On Maggot Street, every Friday night, Le Rado de la Meduse, as painted by Géricault, comes to life above the hot air vents outside Tesco. However, there is a fundamental difference, for here, the down and outs do not look out for ships on the horizon. Instead, in this tableau vivant, their hands hold onto flagons and cans, which for them are the only place where hope abides. The sudden rush of alcohol to the brain momentarily douses the fleet of fire ships and the many bridges in flames. Atomic Summit. This one's for Derek Mann. Whatever happened to the slow serpentine rapture of sweetheart's delight? Like a Haley, you monitor the trajectory of this dark star. Your lines, light crystal, are a form of whiplash we suffer to read during these veritable last few extinguishing hours. tantalize and frenzy are the names of the withered beast's own limited company, its mascot the body of a dead hound, floating somewhere off the coast of Ibiza, where his late master hung high on a pouch, mind splintered into a kind of overkill of fancy, floats high on a lido, walkman in hand, and there's Juvenile's voice, rising like a hooked fin in the water. He will later appear to you in sandals on the beach, like some modern-day Crusoe or predatory tourist, ready to announce a possible 500 years of barbaric silence. Meanwhile, bowls in hand, we sit in the collective mind's blank cell with the proverbial rat for company, whose panhandling arms are our own unique sense of responsibility. The caretaker. Suits of condescension hang inactively inside the closets of malice till the boy or girl step up in their emperor's clothes and slip them into them as smugly and smoothly as only bastards can. After first preening and primping around, these atrocious specimens royally descend the stairs and step out into the forever time-honored space. From here on in, their every gesture will be political. Each decision taken will be governed solely by the absolute calculation. What's in it for me? The marathon hours of polish envelope the body of nepotism in a protective cocoon, which, along with the corrupted magnets of indelicacy, will only further spawn a cancer. This, their poor harvest after years of rich measuring security, the blocks of greed and bile fall off the scales onto the bloated carcasses which float lifelessly through the stagnant marshes and swamps of taut weed. Transition. For Alicia. I entered you like a new country, a traveller abroad, so my sensitivity difference was heightened. My body, too, was similarly highly charged. I recall now the look in your eye when we first met, like a customer's officer at the border. Your interrogation of me was playful, yet relentlessly consistent. Behind the smile, I felt a keen intelligence trying to uncover me. Was I a mere tourist or migrant, or was I possibly a refugee seeking asylum? And if so, from what? Or from whom? Your thought process, like any new language, I had to overcome by careful study in order to master, and to this end I was always looking out for that hidden meaning which lay behind your words, disregarding the vehicle, as it were, a conveyor, and going directly to the source, which, of course, led me to your body and its further, more profound analysis, ever probing. Together, through our touch, we discovered that greater continent of our better self. Our initial union was ideal, the perfect joining of limbs, there, sense. Now we suffer daily from this greater empiricism, cause being disjointed from all effect. Our human transient is absolute. We both levitate in being, Nietzschean in our utter belief in total action. We mitigate how they hawkins to the stars. Orgasm for Roland Barthes. Some rush and bolt of sea like lightning, the fever engendered which you both cradled like junkies there, between the cathedral of fingers announcing your prayers, both being angelic now, at peace, skulls, space findings, the cranium blasted hollow, with the dead weight of the brain's phantasmagoria, expulsed the old dead grey ensouled matter. Now the mind's eye is refreshed, and the inish bank, already hungry for new prey, the tongue prowling for an unaccustomed verb, but you probe for the tip of your tongue, like an apple pip enrobed in spittle. This complex biological software, its electric divinity, and you left both together marveling on the sheets at your sudden, immaculate beginning. Those are all poems taken from the Dark Pool. That's going to take me on to the Trees of Ephesus. I haven't been here in 14 years, and I wrote a poem about Cork. Probably time to get off Dublin. This one's for you, Paul. Just for Cork. Oh, how is our dear, long lost and wretchedly beloved town these days? Does Shannon still toll? Do the streets still walk, and you with them? Tell me, how are the banks? Do the leaves still fall upon them? What does the town tell? Or is the river still the only thing that moves? How are the drinkers at night? How are the children at play? Are there lovers still sitting there in the park? Are there ships in at the quays? How is trade at the market? Are they still queuing up at the door? Tell me, do they still take a coffee in O'Brien's cafe? Do the swans still sleep by the Mersey? How are the women by Peter and Paul's? Do those men still pass their day in the library? How are the hills? Can you still see green down in the valley? And who now is living at 61 Douglas Street? Who looks out the window at Dunbar? And who's this coming now? I can hear their feet. Could it be Nan O'Nagel? It's the hour. And how are? And how are? And how are you? Thank you. John Sexton very graciously put it to Paul that I should come down here and give a reading. I'm hoping I'm not depressing you all. I wrote a poem which I dedicated to John, which was published by Abridge sometime last year. I'd like to start off now just to take a break. The Fields of Ephesus is my fifth collection, and it's kind of I've been writing for almost 30 years, and I was kind of flagging, and I needed a new direction. I needed it's a long time to be writing, and I went to DCU and I met an amazing woman called Brigitte. And we had a lot in common. She was one of the first people that spoke to me about a Franco-Irish literary heritage as opposed to an Anglo-Irish, which they're all going on about in this country for some reason. And that was, you're writing on your own. To meet people who have that similar ideas, maybe perhaps to yourself, it's incredibly encouraging. And literature became for me then more so than a kind of solitary endeavor. She always pushed me, said, Peter, you need to start meeting people, basically. And it's great advice. And this is a poem that I dedicated to John. It's called The Fields of Ephesus.
Ephesus is a city in Turkey, and it's famous really because of Heraclitus, who became an enormous obsession of mine. He was always in the back of my head, but through a reading of Beckett's Commencer, I got completely obsessed, and I wrote a trilogy of books about which I call a Heraclitean trilogy. So this is the first one, and this is for you, John, In the Fields of Ephesus. The illuminations uncovered at Ephesus, the way the light unfolds each leaf set against the cloud, formations of Brugal and Callao, further reveal that nature too has memory and aesthetic. Here in Ephesus, we are not in Eden. I am reminded too that the apples are all gone. Under the boughs, the year's delicious harvest is indeterminate. Fresh shit mixed with all manner of pain today, followed possibly by more Tom Morrow. Or perhaps strawberries, take upon it and mind me place your feet. Oh, and by the way, don't ask why there is a bearded lady crucified against the sky, flayed ceaselessly by dominatrixes, nor why two Pico's giants hail Prometheus. The Elm Tree. The title of this kind of selected works is called The Elm Tree, and so this is the title poem. As Eugenio Montale once wrote, poets from different ages past have always eulogized about very specific plants and trees. He himself had his lemon, while Cesare and Dante before him had both their laurels and bays. And in England, did Marvel himself continue that tradition? The English were always fascinated with Italian gardens, a fascination, as our great country houses show, which still endures. Now, pan in to a modern housing estate built on the cusp of the great 21st century downturn. Not quite exactly ghostly, but more a development abandoned. So that when I look out the main window from this two-bedroom room, I can see just this lone elm before me, evoking Godot and Belvedere. It stands solitary, yet upward, ablaze against the abyss of changing cloud. Sweeney of Ephesus. And Sweeney stood there before the tree. I could be anywhere, he thought, scratching his head. Eden, Ephesus, or Park Marnock on the Seventh. I could even be one of those tramps in Godot, waiting for just another rough rope, or out in the badlands that were once the Amazon. Such is metaphor, he thought, grounded in the literal. He approached it, touching it. Its bark felt rough against his soft palm. It came as a kind of shock to him, the sensation. And that is when it came to him, the sudden realization that this was no elm nestling within the shades of hell, but something far less portentous, more like a symbol then, or on which he had yet to attach a sign. I was very moved by Seamus Heaney's last book, The Human Chain. He was sick, we knew he was going to die, and it was very clear in that book. And what amazed me about that book, which I think is one of his most personal, was his engagement with Virgil. And I see it like a kind of jamming. And this is the power of literature, where you're connecting with the past. So this is I wrote this for Seamus Heaney around 6 months before he died. I was published in a New Ulster, thanks to Amos Greig, and I was hoping that maybe Seamus Heaney might have read it. I don't know if he did. But anyway, it's my response to his Human Chain. It's called Ulmus Opacha, which comes from a line from the Aeneid, passage, the Stygian elm in the sixth book. Vegetative fibrous roots and boughs, parentum stridens, delicately coiled around each arrow-headed leaf. This architectural wonder of the elm trees with the great lozenge passing overhead, its cosmicity encircling the globe. Below, the unfolding palms of the branches seemingly gracing the orb in playful embrace, illuminating at the same time the lantern phenomenon of the day tree, prefiguring the street lights. Nature's civic pride on full display with the light trees, but no wires, she seems to say. We, the so-called guardians, in clear distress, seemingly oblivious. Troia, per Filippo de Montis. Whores in English, Troia in Italiano, or one from Troy, not Trojan, but like Helena, la bella Helena, reduced to a mere puttana. This is what they call them here. Within the microcosm of this solitary world, we have the genesis of the Mediterranean. Everything is still so proximate, whether it is the whores in Palermo, or indeed those within the Parlamento, as they are called by Battiato. Troia, 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 Troia! See within the oracle of the world the ships of the Achaeans burning. Here also the stigmata of the universally accursed. Sweeney at Ugolino's Pizzeria. Strategically placed by the train station in a small town called Siliqua in southern Sardinia, there, under the Kafkaesque shadows of Il Castello of the Acrofella, Sweeney sat out of it, the heat, sipping in parla de natura. The television screen pewed out image after atrocious image of some scenes from Aleppo, corpses rolling up like mummies and were laid out side by side, till one of the diners complained, wanting to see the match. As the proprietor stepped in, bearing the remote switch like a prize, Il Cavaliere next appeared, grinning buffoonishly before pronouncing to the assembled gathering, Vergognatevi! Siete dei poveri ignoranti stupidi! The footballer's letter transformed then into a human head. A fistful of dollars. This is in memory of my brother, Michael. Ennio Morricone is playing on the turntable. The weather price tag from Eason seals the context, which is Cork in the 1980s. Steel guitars, bull whips, church organs and castanets, added to which the feverish roll of drumsticks upon a snare, all such heady Latin drama animating the epic painting sessions which always had a matte finish. And as we watched the paint dry almost literally, the whole chorus of angels, dark and glorious, raised up by bassoon and clarinets, further prophecies the aberration of our most poignant doom and depression, which were both physical and clinical, both of which were laying waste to the whole land, and which you put an end to with that infamous hangman's knot. I'm going to finish up with a few poems from Dublin Gothic. This first one is called Transhumance, and it's for Alicia Rubio. On the way from Siliqua to Porta Palma, out on the flat roads beneath the ruin of Acrofeda, crumbling upon the crown of the mound, this pyramid of hills, straight out of a storybook,
though historical, infused as it is with cannibalism. Canto 33 of Dante Alighieri's Inferno. Back on the murmuring rocks, running to the pool of Rio Mortas, drowned there in the register's pupil, a sacred halting place. It is written on the wind, this juxtaposed vision, passing moments iconic, your own deaf temple, the Dublin Gothic. The Sabre of Joseph Roth. I've stopped reading a lot of fiction, but Joseph Roth, I was reading last summer for the Dead Sea Merchant. I dedicated this to a friend and editor, Adam Henry Carrier, who edited and published a lot of my work in Dance Macabre, and this was for him. He's a great fan. A wedge of matinal illumination in burnished gold silently filters between the folds at the bottom of the heavy curtains, announcing quietly the arrival of summer after almost half a year of winter. You cherish what is rare because of the permanence of it ever returning, like the classroom you once enjoyed in the classrooms of laughter, its contraband making it vomit-inducing. Such is the risk of all leave-taking, the wager in the weight of the delay, which is contrasted starkly with the vehement metaphysics of all human decay. Final poem, it's a long one. Dublin Gothic is the title poem. If I read another poem going diddly idle do, with that same insane cadence and rhythm as that blasted music falling out of the innumerable Blarney Stones, but it's oh so happy I'm Irish manure, I swear I'll fuck the bloody book over this garden wall. That's not Irish. That's shite. Irish? What's Irish? So I hear you here. A pint of black stout, 95% dark as your soul, with just a light, creamy head of hope, a mere 5%. With that object then in front of you, there in some dark and snug, perhaps Martin Hayes playing in the distance. Utter dissonance. The truth is, I don't know what Irish means. But when I do hear that word, I think of a house which doesn't exist on Tritonville Road in Sandymount. Am I walking into eternity along the Sandymount Strand? Just down from the old Oscar Cinema across the road, which also doesn't exist. There in that old Victorian house with the great bays flooding the rooms with a singular light filtering in through the ivy trees in the front garden. There it was always Christmas with the scarlet sash of the great front door, on either side of which rested the Ionian columns, English, Roman and Greek, all leading to Irish. But it was what went on inside that really struck me. My grandfather threatening to throw my father's copy of Ulysses out the window. That strikes me as being very Irish. How many more like that are like he was still? My grandfather, the great patriot who was jailed by the British for his part in the War of Independence. There is your locus to it now, the old sepia-stained framed image of him posing calmly in his Free State uniform with your grandmother by his side after he was released from Wormwood Scrubs. Thanks to the change in public opinion, he was now a hero. His sword hung laconically. They stood together like that, he and her, side by side for a full lifetime. Is that being Irish? There is a night I will always remember, sleeping there as a child and awaking from nightmare to copse hall of shadows, trembling there in knotted limbs and book-involved vegetation. Then, by the window, lunar upon the third floor, 3 ages of women meet, which you dare as on Macbeth's heat, though this encounter more chillingly Scandinavian, the pigeon house view, nowhere to be seen in sight, which many, many years you would connect to the tune, if I should fall from place with pride. Standing there, ready to emigrate, contemplating the open horizon.
Here, that was fantastic.